Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. This week my guest is Dr. Alan Robock, Professor of Climatology in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University and the Associate Director of its Center for Environmental Prediction. Alan Robock has published more than 250 articles on his research in the area of climate change, including more than 150 peer-reviewed papers. He is a Fellow of the American Meteorological Society and President-elect of the Atmospheric Sciences Section of the American Geophysical Union. Alan graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1970 with a BA in Meteorology and from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology with an SM in 1974 and a PhD in 1977 in Meteorology. Before graduate school, he served as a Peace Corps volunteer in the Philippines. In October 2007, Professor Robock won the Nobel Peace Prize as one of the 2,500 members of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Alan Robock, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Let's go back to the beginning when the meteorologists got together in the 80s to look at the climate effects of a massive nuclear exchange between Russia and America. And Alan, I believe you were part of that group that did that seminal work.
Yes, in the 1980s, the Swedish journal Ambio had a special issue on the consequences of nuclear war. Paul Crutzen and John Birks were asked to write about air pollution after nuclear war, and they were particularly interested in ozone and how it would be formed by all the pollutants that we put in the air. But that requires sunlight, the reaction that produces ozone. And they realized that there would be fires and smoke that would block out the sun. And they said this might have consequences for climate. As soon as they did that, the climatologists started working on how much climate change there would be. And we were very surprised to find out that it could get as cold in the summertime as it is in the winter. And Richard Turco named this nuclear winter. About a year after the first papers were published, I also published a paper looking at the long-term effects of nuclear winter.
Okay, so go back then to the early 80s. How many nuclear weapons did America have targeted on Russia, and how many did Russia have targeted on America? In other words, what was the megatonnage of the total arsenal that you used to estimate your nuclear winter and ozone depletion studies?
In 1985, there were about 50,000 nuclear warheads in the world. U.S. had about, and Russia each had about 10,000 strategic warheads, which are on intercontinental missiles and bombers, and they each had about 15,000 theater weapons, which are for battlefield. They use these words like exchange and theater sort of to sanitize the language and not think about the horror that they're talking about. So a ton is the equivalent of the explosive power of TNT, the weight of TNT. So the world had 15,000 megatons of explosive power with 50,000 weapons in 1985. To get some feel for what that number means, in all the history of the war, all the history of the world, in all of warfare, the total yield of all bombs is about 10 megatons. So we had 1,000 times more explosive power than all of them used in the entire history of our planet.
And you took into account the tactical nuclear weapons. In other words, the battlefield nuclear weapons dropped from planes or launched from missile launches on the shoulders of soldiers, plus the strategic weapons on intercontinental ballistic missiles and planes. Did you?
You asked what was the how many were targeted?
Yeah.
The targeting is secret, so there were different scenarios chosen. The baseline scenario was to use about a third of the arsenal,
right?
And it would be dropped both on cities and on missile silos.
Right.
And so if you bomb cities, they burn and it produces smoke. And the smoke goes up in the atmosphere and blocks out the sun and makes it cold and dark at the Earth's surface. The dust from the ground burst also reflects sunlight. In both cases, very little sunlight reaches the world. And so a baseline scenario, sort of a full-scale nuclear war, was designed, and estimates were made of how much smoke and how much dust would go up into the atmosphere.
Mm.
And then we calculated how the climate would change in response to that.
So my understanding, Alan, is that the two air masses in the northern and southern hemisphere don't tend to mix. So you've got all this smoke in the northern hemisphere going up into the troposphere and stratosphere, but does it filter down then to the southern hemisphere?
Yes, because the smoke absorbs so much sunlight, it gets heated and rises up. And the model simulations show that it would go up and into the southern hemisphere and cover the whole planet.
The whole planet. Within what period of time after
two or three weeks.
2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Really?
And so, you know, this is a theory. This is a climate model simulation, and we never want to do the experiment. So one of the ways we test our theory is to look for analogs, things that have happened in other places and other times, other things to tell us whether it makes some sense. And if you look at our neighboring planet Mars, occasionally there are dust storms which start in one hemisphere, and the same mechanism that happens. They get heated by the sun, and the dust ends up covering the planet in a couple weeks.
Right.
So we think that that this theory at least works on Mars and probably would work here. Although, and, as I said, we never want to do the experiment.
No, so at that time in 1985 and the like, what materials in cities actually burn to produce this sort of smoke?
I remember going into buildings and looking at the roof. The asphalt tiles are made of oil. They burn with this black city smoke. Anything made of plastic will, like carpets or furniture, will burn it with black smoke. Wood burns with a whiter colored smoke. And so inventories were made of buildings in typical cities, and calculations were made of how much material there was, how much smoke would be produced, maybe a couple percent of it would actually end up as smoke, and then how much would be taken out of the atmosphere rapidly by rain, and how much would remain in the atmosphere. And what would remain is what would cause the climate change.
So when you made these calculations, this very prestigious international group of scientists, how long did you estimate that the smoke would remain in the atmosphere to block out the sun, and how efficiently was the sun actually blocked out to reach the surface of the Earth?
We didn't know how long the smoke would stay, and at the time, there weren't big enough computers or sophisticated enough climate models to do very long-term calculations. And so some of the fastest computers in the world produced simulations of what would happen in 20 days or 40 days. And so the smoke was still in the atmosphere, and the only thing we had was estimates based on volcanic eruptions, which occur occasionally. And there the particles stay about a year or two. So people estimated maybe it would be a year or two, but nobody had really done the calculation.
And how dark would it be?
Well, we've repeated this calculation recently with a modern climate model, and we find that the smoke would last for more than 10 years.
10 years.
And so, you know, critics of it said, well, you know, once there are a lot of unknowns, once you work out the unknowns, the problem will go away. But, you know, unknowns by definition are unknown, and you can be wrong in terms of making it too bad or too good. And it turns out we underestimated the effects.
It reminds me of Donald Rumsfeld. There are known
knowns
and known unknowns and unknown unknowns.
Exactly.
So at last,
The sun heats the smoke particles, and they rise up into the upper stratosphere, and they're tiny little particles and fall very slowly. And so our new calculations show that it would last for more than 10 years, and the climate effects would last for many years, not just for a few days or a few months that we simulated.
And how dark would it actually be, you know, at noon?
Well, a full nuclear winter using a third of the arsenal in the 1980s or the entire arsenal today would produce global average temperature changes about 8 degrees colder than normal, 8 degrees Celsius, which is about 15 degrees Fahrenheit. There would be freezing in the middle of the continents for years, and so it would be really bad. It would be virtually impossible to conduct any agriculture for years on the planet.
And freezing.
Yeah, the temperatures would go below freezing and stay there for a couple of years.
We're talking about the total arsenal today could do that if it was used, and we'll talk about that in a little while. But there is a tremendous concern, as you obviously know, about global warming. But compared to global warming, a nuclear winter would be of orders of magnitude more severe, would it not?
That's right. The planet has warmed by about a little less than 1 degree Celsius in the past 100 years.
Mm.
And nuclear winter would plunge it to temperatures much colder than ice ages, in which huge ice sheets cover the continents. The ice sheets would take a long time to grow, so they wouldn't appear instantly, but it would be that cold.
But millions or billions would die freezing to death in the dark, right?
I think the main concern is not so much freezing directly as lack of food.
Yeah,
because, you know, my local food supply is the grocery store down the street, and I don't know how to grow food. But even if I knew how, the conditions wouldn't be right to grow it. So only if you've actually hoarded food and saved up, and you know, if you had a fallout shelter with enough food and enough weapons to keep all the other hungry people out, you might survive for a little bit longer.
Sounds grotesque. So what about the ozone? Would there be, in your original calculations, what was the ozone depletion? What did that look like? And why does the ozone get depleted with a nuclear war?
The heating of the upper stratosphere changes the reaction rates, and virtually all the ozone would disappear.
Can you describe that chemistry to us as a lay audience?
Yeah, there's two things. A nuclear bomb is so hot that it basically burns the air. Yeah, the main constituents of the air are nitrogen and oxygen.
Yeah.
And they combine into nitrous oxide.
Yeah.
NO, NO2. And this catalytically destroys the ozone. What that means is the NO combines with ozone to produce something else, which then combines with the product to give back the NO, but the result is the ozone gets depleted.
Well, give us the equation. It's O3, which is ozone, plus NO equals?
O2.
NO2.
Yeah. And then the NO2 plus O makes NO plus O2.
Yeah, right.
So so you get ozone, the net is O3 plus O, ozone plus single oxygen makes two O2, two oxygen molecules.
Yeah.
And the NO comes back, and so it does it again, and it's a catalyst. It goes over and over and over again.
It's like nuclear waste up there. I mean, how long does it last? How long do these reactions go on for?
Well, they go on until the NO goes away and the ozone goes away.
How long is that?
Years.
So what sort of ozone depletion would we be looking at, like 70% or?
Yeah, something like that. That's one effect, and that was actually known before we worked on nuclear winter.
Mm.
It was known that the huge bombs that had been created would go up in the atmosphere and bring the NO up there and destroy ozone. And so that was even known before we did it. That was about the only environmental consequence of nuclear war that people talked about. But nuclear winter, as you mentioned before, produces another effect. It blows all the air with the ozone into the southern hemisphere because of this change in circulation. And what happens is the air with the ozone in the stratosphere is replaced with air from below that doesn't have any ozone. And so you're actually blowing the ozone away. And the first effect is the ozone in the southern hemisphere goes up because you're blowing all the northern hemisphere ozone down there. But then that gets destroyed later by the chemistry, and you end up with very little ozone anywhere.
Well, and I'm talking to you from Canberra, Australia, and we don't have a lot of ozone anyway, particularly in the summer, so we would be at very high risk. I'm now speaking to Professor Alan Robock, who is a professor of climatology in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University, and this program is called If You Love This Planet. Alan, I know that the work that you and Paul Crutzen, who's the Nobel laureate, and Toon and others did on nuclear winter in 1985 produced a huge impact in the thinking of the politicians and scientists and general public around the world when The Cold and the Dark, the book about your studies, was produced by Norton. People got a hell of a shock. And I think that was partly responsible for inducing the end of the Cold War. I know that Gorbachev understood that and Reagan eventually did. They met in Reykjavik in 87 to try and get rid of nuclear weapons totally, which they failed to do, but...
They almost succeeded. The thing that they stopped on was Star Wars. Gorbachev insisted that they only be in the laboratory, and Reagan insisted that they be able to test it in the atmosphere, and they couldn't agree. And it turns out it didn't work, of course. So if Gorbachev hadn't cared, it wouldn't have worked. If Reagan had said, let's just keep it in the laboratory, that wouldn't have affected it either because it never worked. And so if either of them had agreed with the other's position, they could have ended up with nuclear abolition. It's a real tragedy that they got stopped on that one item.
Oh, it just makes me feel sick, I have to tell you. So your group of scientists really did a noble job for the planet in getting people to understand in great depth what an all-out nuclear war would mean between Russia and America. Now, I know in talking to you, Alan, that you then were quite viciously attacked by the nuclear weapons industry and nuclear weapons scientists subsequent to your study being published. Tell us about that era in history.
Well, I would go to meetings about this, and you could predict the results of different scientists based on what you knew about their politics. People were finding results based on their preconceptions.
What years and were these? What years?
These were in the 1980s.
1980s, right, yeah.
But it really made people start talking about nuclear weapons again, not just the climate effects, but the direct effects. And we had this rapid rise in nuclear weapons, and nobody was paying much attention. And we got more and more weapons with no targets, and they just kept building up and up and up. And getting people to talk about it, I mean, in the United States and the Soviet Union, the direct effects of nuclear war would be so horrible that people didn't care much about the climate effects. But countries in, you know, one of the results was that more people in India or China could die from nuclear war than in Russia and the U.S. combined, even if no bombs were dropped there because of the climate response. And so they started really pressuring the superpowers to reduce nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Now, Mikhail Gorbachev was asked about this later, and he commented, let me read a quote from you. This was an interview in 1994, and he talked about when he received control over the Soviet nuclear arsenal. He said, perhaps there was an emotional side to it, but it was rectified by my knowledge of the might that had been accumulated. 1/1000th of this might was enough to destroy all living things on Earth, and I knew the report on nuclear winter. And then he was interviewed by Salon.com in 2000, and he said, models made by Russian and American scientists showed that a nuclear war would result in a nuclear winter that would be extremely destructive to all life on Earth. The knowledge of that was a great stimulus to us, to people of honor and morality, to act in that situation.
Yeah.
So we think that this reduction of the number of nuclear weapons in the world, which started in 1986 before the end of the Soviet Union, was partly caused by people now thinking about how crazy the arms race was.
But then you told me that you were quite viciously attacked by the nuclear weapons industry and that a lot of your colleagues and you yourself were intimidated to continue with your studies and to talk about nuclear winter. Is that so? And when did that happen?
It depends in what forum. Scientists got together and some people were criticizing the results, and there were a lot of policy analysts who were criticizing it. You know, if your job was to look at nuclear weapons policy and the conclusion of our work was that nuclear weapons cannot be used, then you lose your job. You've got nothing to spend the rest of your life trying to figure out. If you're trying to figure out how to use them and they can't be used, people just couldn't accept that conclusion. They just couldn't think that way. And so they were really trying to push back no matter how they could. But I think that in spite of the sniping and the articles that were written, people did pay attention and the arms race ended. The problem was really pretty simple. If you put enough smoke in the atmosphere, no sunlight gets through and it gets cold and dark. The biggest unknown was how much smoke.
Right.
And that would depend on the different scenarios of what the targets would be. And so we just wanted to do experiments of different scenarios and show what the consequences would be. But after that, there wasn't like much more work to do, and we went on to do other things. We built new climate models to answer this question. They became very useful for looking at global warming and other science, but you know, we weren't politicians, and we sort of didn't then proceed with a political campaign because we just didn't know how. I mean, some of the people that worked on this were rewarded. Richard Turco got a MacArthur Fellowship, a Genius Award, and Steve Schneider ended up getting one later, but partly because of this. And so my scientific career, I think, probably was delayed by this because I worked on it and I didn't do other things. I didn't get as much money for grants. I didn't have as many students, but I couldn't not do it. It's something that I had to do. But, you know, I went on to other problems, and once this one was sort of solved, but we, you know, nothing else was quite as exciting as that.
No, though. Well, I'm talking to Dr. Alan Robock, Professor of Climatology at the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. And on that note, Alan, I want to move up to the present time. I want you to tell us how many nuclear weapons there are in the Russian and American arsenal. I know of the 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, Russia and America own 97%. How many are ready to go, you know, to launch within a half an hour period? And what would that mean now to the nuclear winter scenario and data, A? And B, I know you've done another study on a very small regional nuclear war. So I'd first like you to describe what is happening now between Russia and America and what it means to the climate of the world, and compare that to global warming, if you will, and then we'll move on to the Indian-Pakistan scenario.
Well, as I understand it right now, Russia and the U.S. still each have about 10,000 weapons. There's a treaty that requires them to reduce each to about 2,000 weapons by the year 2012, but it's not to reduce and get rid of them, it's just to take them and put them on the shelf. And
yeah.
So the weapons are still sitting around.
Yep.
They won't be on missiles, but quickly they could be used again.
Yep.
And so the trend is downward. Both countries are reducing their number of weapons. But, you know, Russia still has about 20,000 weapons, but only about 7,000 or 8,000 are ready to be used right now. But that's still a tremendous number. So we did some recent simulations, as I mentioned, of using the entire arsenal now, which is about equal to a third of what it was before.
Yeah.
We also did a simulation of using a third of the current arsenal, which would not produce nuclear winter, but it would produce a huge climate change anyway, and it would be devastating to agriculture. So we still have the potential for tremendous climate change from these weapons. Of, you know, the both countries say that they are friends, they aren't targeted at each other, so it makes you ask the question, well, why do they still have these weapons, and who are they targeted at?
Well, why don't you try and answer that? I know you're only a scientist, but, you know, you have to extrapolate now into the political sphere.
I'm only a scientist.
and I'm only a doctor.
Yeah. Well, I just read Jonathan Schell's new book, and so I'll tell you his theory, which makes a lot of sense
okay.
to me. The U.S. during Bush has decided to target the entire world and become a world power and threaten everybody. With nuclear weapons. And they've been incorporated into war-fighting strategies, not even against nuclear enemies, but against everybody. That makes it really scary.
Everybody and anybody, yep.
And Russia keeps theirs because we have ours. So it doesn't make any sense at all.
We're in the hands of extremely dangerous sociopathic people, I believe, and I'm talking now as a clinician.
The five members of the UN Security Council are the first five countries to have nuclear weapons.
Yeah, that's crazy too, isn't it?
I don't think that's a coincidence. But the problem is now there are four more countries with nuclear weapons. Let me tell you the story. A couple years ago at a conference, Brian Toon and Rich Turco walked up to me and said, you know, we've been looking at what would happen if India and Pakistan had a nuclear war, each using 50 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons.
Which they have. Right.
And that's about 0.3% of the current global arsenal.
Yep.
And they calculated how much smoke would be generated from the fires in the cities that would burn from these 50 targets in each country.
Mm-hmm.
And they calculated 20 million people would die from the direct effects. And I said, well, who's going to calculate the climate response to that? And they said, well, we thought maybe you would. And so it turned out Luke Oman, a student, was just finishing, and Georgi Stenchikov, with whom I work, we were ready to do it because we had a climate model, and so we went and did it. And we found that a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, using 50 weapons each, would produce climate change unprecedented in human history. It would be cooling of a little more than a degree Celsius, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, colder than the Little Ice Age, during which famine occurred. It wouldn't be nuclear winter, but it would be a tremendous shock to the climate system. In fact, growing season in the mid-latitudes in Australia in the southern hemisphere, in Russia and the U.S. in the northern hemisphere, would be shortened by 20, 30 days. And so some crops which might never reach maturity, and it might produce a food crisis around the world. We haven't done a detailed analysis of each crop and the specific climate response. But now, shockingly, India and Pakistan threaten the rest of the world with a climate change if they use their nuclear weapons.
And what about ozone depletion?
Brian Toon and Mike Mills, one of his students, just published a paper showing the ozone effect. From this war with only 100 nuclear weapons, I hate to say only 100 nuclear weapons, but they found that about half the ozone in the world would disappear. There would be like the same level as is in the ozone hole now around Antarctica, but
yeah.
Globally.
Oh, my God.
The upper atmosphere would be heated about 50 degrees Celsius, and that would just speed up the reactions that destroy ozone.
Do you think the leaders of the world have any comprehension of what this means?
No, we're trying to get the word out. We had a press conference at our meeting, and there were a few articles in the newspaper, but we've had a hard time getting heard. Thanks to you now, we're being heard on the radio, and it looks like we have organized some briefings in Washington this summer, but most people haven't been paying attention.
Do you know what you need to do, Alan? You need to get to see Obama.
I think he's a highly intelligent man.
Well, I'm going to have to try and help you get there, and you've got to go and see Hillary.
That's right.
Break down the door if necessary. I mean, this is something of extreme urgency, and they have to hear about it, and so does John McCain. And I don't care what minders they've got around them. You've got a message that you're like the Minuteman. You're the new Minuteman.
If you know how to do that, I've written them letters, but I haven't got any.
Oh no, they never get the letters. You've got to do something, I think, sort of classy too in terms of the media, because you know how Greenpeace always gets the attention of the media. They're clever. Now I know you're scientists, and you know you're a little bit, you know, stay in your labs and the like. But somehow you've got to do something that looks good on television so they'll come and cover you. And then they put a mark in your face and say, what are you doing this for? And you say, because this, and the Earth is threatened.
There is a movie being planned on nuclear abolition during this coming year, and I'm going to be interviewed for it.
Mm.
I went to a conference at Yale University on nuclear abolition, and many of the people working on it were there. In fact, Ted Turner was in the audience, and he heard my talk.
Yeah.
So not much has come of that yet, but I hope some of those contacts will try to get the word out.
Yes, I think we're in a remarkably dangerous era of intense psychic numbing. I think if you watch the coverage of the presidential debates, my God, it's whether you wear an American flag on your lapel and, you know, you might say the word bitter and all this absolute rubbish. And none of the media are attending to the real issues at hand facing the planet, which really is, you know, global warming. The candidates are not being cross-examined about that and why it's occurring. Nuclear winter and nuclear war, and the fact is that we could have what they call a nuclear exchange tonight between Russia and America or India and Pakistan, and that's absolutely on the cards. No one's talking about that. That's the elephant in the sitting room. And
well, Barack Obama has actually come out for nuclear abolition.
He's
the only candidate who
has. Yes, I agree with that, but he needs to enlarge upon that and the environmental consequences of the whole nuclear war scenario. And then last but not least, and I know that you understand this too, Alan, is the long-term environmental, genetic and mutagenic effect of nuclear power, which they're now posing to be the answer to global warming, right?
Oh, yeah. Nuclear power. I mean, the global warming problem, which I spend most of my time working on, can be solved without nuclear power. Nuclear power is a bad idea for a number of reasons. The main reason is that it produces nuclear proliferation. And we made this Atoms for Peace deal, this non-proliferation treaty, which got countries in the world to agree not to have weapons if we gave them nuclear power, and they ended up using the nuclear power stations
to make nuclear weapons. Oh, my God.
And if Sarkozy manages to sell French nuclear reactors around the world, that will just help other countries to get nuclear weapons. You know, the United States right now is trying to tell Iran not to have nuclear weapons, but what kind of example are we setting? We're keeping ours. How can they expect any country in the world to do as we say and not as we do?
Oh, I know.
I mean, right now, the U.S. and Russia each have about 10,000. The next four countries each have about 200 or 300, France, China, Britain, and Israel. And so they decided that 200 weapons is enough to deter any attack on them. So how many weapons do you have to put on the capital city of your opponent to deter them to attack you? Isn't like one the answer to that question? And they've decided, okay, one's the answer. I've got 200. That's enough. So why doesn't the U.S. and Russia immediately go down to 200 and then do abolition after that? Why do we still have 10,000?
Well, I think there are 60 H-bombs targeted on Washington, on Moscow. And Robert McNamara and I wrote an article for the L.A. Times that there are 40 H-bombs targeted on New York City alone, and yet the politicians harp endlessly about, quote, terrorists. I mean, from my perspective, and I'm intervening here a little, the two terrorist nations, rogue nations in the world, absolutely are Russia and America, holding the world at nuclear ransom, and no one really talks about that.
Yeah, those are the real weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. I'm interviewing Professor Alan Robock, who's a climatologist at the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. Alan, I'd like now, as you've just stated, you're doing most of your work on global warming now. Can you just give us a brief summary of what you've been finding and your feelings based on your data and other people's data and James Hansen's data about where we're progressing now in terms of global warming?
I wouldn't use the word progressing. The humans continue to put gases into the atmosphere that cause global warming, and the rate that we're putting them in is continuing to go up. We are quite aware now of the consequences of it, but the political will still doesn't exist to do anything about it. The U.S., again, is not setting any example. We've just been delaying because of the current administration for the last 7 years doing anything about it. And we're the biggest polluter in the world, although China's just about caught up now. And we don't set any example for the rest of the world. And so it's hard to get the rest of the world to do anything about it. Europe has made much more of a commitment to address this problem. But even though they say that, there's not much evidence that they've reduced their emissions yet. The problem is changes of agriculture, water supplies, sea level rise, and those are pretty well known. The problem is fossil fuels are the root of our source of energy, and coal, oil, natural gas are what we burn. They're the cheapest fuels. And so in order for this problem to be solved, there has to be a political problem to tax them or restrict them. And this will make other sources more competitive economically, and it will produce a huge development of other sources of energy. In fact, there's an example in New Jersey where I live. The state has a program that will subsidize solar power. So we just put solar panels on our house, and New Jersey paid for more than half of them.
Oh, that's wonderful. How much did it cost you then in the long run?
Within 6 or 7 years, it will pay for itself, because they're also going to give us certificates every year that the electric company has to buy from us, because they have to generate a certain amount of their energy from renewable sources.
Does it feel good to generate your
own? Oh, yeah, yeah. Our electric meter today was flying backwards, and we were selling power to the electric company because we generated more than we used.
Can you run your refrigerator and your iron and your stove and all the rest?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If we generate more than we use, it goes backwards. If we use more than we generate, we take a little from the electric company, but the net effect, we get credit for all the electricity we generate.
Isn't that exciting?
But, we couldn't have afforded it if we had to pay for it all ourselves. The government subsidized it, and that was a political decision of our state, because our country isn't doing anything. So each state, like California, New Jersey, New York, have different programs to try and deal with it, sort of on a patchwork basis. But it's much harder than if there was leadership in the White House.
Well, go on.
All of the presidential candidates in the United States, including John McCain, have a good position on global warming. McCain, in fact, introduced bills in Congress to restrict greenhouse gas emissions. So I think things are going to change within another year, no matter who the president is. But still, it's going to be a very difficult problem because the entrenched interests that make money now with business as usual, the big fossil fuel companies, oil, gas, coal, are going to have a lot of power and money, and they don't want to stop what they're doing.
No.
However, you know, dealing with this provides a huge economic opportunity for people. I think the richest guy in China makes solar panels, and we're putting wind power now up in Texas, but we're buying the generators from Europe because they've developed the technology and the U.S. is lagging behind.
It's so unlike the U.S. because usually in the past it's been so progressive in its development of technology and led the world. You see, the Pentagon is now spending more than $700 billion on weapons per year. It's more like a trillion. It's all on death and destruction. And here we have a problem which could be solved if the money was put into putting solar panels on the roof of every single house in America, solar hot water systems, solar panels on the parking lots all over America where you could plug your hybrid car into the solar panels and charge up your hybrid and drive on solar power. I mean, the solutions are all there, and the frustration, it's like having a really dinky sort of hopeless surgeon, and I trained with a few in my medical school, you know, doing operations on your belly and sewing up the wrong bits of bowel to the wrong other bits of bowel, and you end up with peritonitis and intestinal obstruction and stuff. I mean, these people need, on a basis of urgency, to be removed from the power structure. And the only way, and I'm ranting a little bit now, I'm sorry, but the only way that could happen is, and I'm talking seriously now, is a revolution in thinking and action by the ordinary American people who have enough information to say, okay, sport, that's it. We're taking over now, and this is what is to happen. Do you agree with that, Alan? I know you're a scientist.
Yeah.
You're stepping out of your comfort zone, but...
I agree, and it's happening. Al Gore's movie went a huge step in the right direction.
Yep.
I gave a talk in Princeton on Sunday on global warming. I'm giving one in my town, in Wall Township. And so people are speaking out and gradually being educated. You know, 3 years ago, we bought our first hybrid car, and we had a choice of a Japanese car or a Japanese car. Now, what does that say about the American auto industry?
Well, it's going down the tubes, isn't it?
They're building hybrids now slowly, but they just wanted to keep selling big cars and make more money and not develop what technology the world needs. And
do you know there's a big fashion now in New York, Alan? People are driving around in Hummers. Can you believe that? All Hummers are parked in all the little streets of New York.
Well, car companies make more money selling those big cars than the little ones because the policymakers let them do it, and they have a big influence. And so that's true with many things. Now, I think that either, you know, this is just my political opinion, either of the Democratic candidates, we have two excellent ones. That's the problem. They're both excellent. Either one will make huge changes in that. Mm. They'll be fighting against entrenched interests, but things will really change.
Do you know what these companies remind me of? That, like drug pushers, you know, they're pushing heroin on the population, but it's much worse because heroin only damages the person taking the drug, whereas these huge Hummers and huge vehicles and the like, and the coal industry and the like, that's going to damage not just the human species, but up to 30 million other species quite rapidly, actually.
In fact, the oil companies are using the same agencies that tried to convince us that smoking wasn't dangerous.
I know, and so do the nuclear companies, Hill and Knowlton. Yep.
They're using the same techniques to try and confuse the public about the science and to delay doing anything about it.
Yeah, I've only got one word for that, and it's evil. And I know people don't like that word, but we are facing the extinction really quite rapidly in evolutionary terms of many of the species that are so absolutely wonderful that have evolved over millions of years. And we are doing it almost consciously, saying, oh, well, I mean, I remember talking to a man once who was making cruise missiles armed with nuclear weapons. And I said to him, he was quite a young man, I said, what about your children? He looked at me with eyes like dead stones and said, I'm making money. And I said, yeah, but what about your children and their future? And he repeated the statement. And yet, I have to say, when I've treated people who are on their deathbed, who've made cruise missiles or whatever, or whose children are dying, they fall into my arms and all of this awful sort of conditioning and wickedness falls away, and there you're looking at their pure soul and they know that what they've done has been really evil. But it's too late then because they're dying or they're losing their child. In other words, I do believe, and I don't know if you agree with me or not, Alan, that inherent in every soul, There's absolute goodness that knows right from wrong. And if that can be tapped by you, the scientists, putting out your data and talking about it in a passionate way and the like, that people will come around to absolutely want to do the right thing. Do you agree?
Well, let me just mention one thing. People have proposed geoengineering to save us from global warming. That's putting particles in the stratosphere to block out the sun and stop it from getting warmer. And I've been working on that recently, and I've thought of 20 reasons why this might be a bad idea.
Tell us.
And I've written a paper which was published in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, 20 reasons why geoengineering may be a bad idea. So I recommend it to you all. The main reason is that if people think that we can solve the problem with this sort of Band-Aid, they'll stop trying to do mitigation. They'll stop trying to stop putting the gases into the atmosphere.
What are the other reasons?
Well, it would cause drought in Asia and Africa, causing a threat to the food supply for billions of people. It would destroy ozone. It could be used as a weapon. It would violate current treaties. There could be mistakes from it. It would allow the ocean to continue to get acidified by the carbon in the atmosphere, which is about half of what we put into the atmosphere comes out, and about half of that goes into the ocean, making it more acidic and destroying corals. That would continue. So there are a number of reasons why this is not the solution.
Who are the people proposing this crazy notion then?
Well,
and why?
It turns out Paul Crutzen wrote a paper 2 years ago, Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, the first person that figured out nuclear winter, was so distraught about humanity not doing anything about global warming, he suggested we might need this as an emergency measure if nothing else happens. And I think he was probably trying to stimulate people to think if it's going to get that bad, maybe we should do something to solve the problem. But it was, you know, he was very prominent, and that got a lot of attention because he wrote that paper. That's why a lot more people are thinking about it now.
I'm interviewing Professor Alan Robock, who's a climatologist at the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University, on the program of If You Love This Planet. It's all very relevant to whether you do love the planet or not and the sort of actions you will take to save it. I want to move on to something that's really been gnawing at me, Alan, because I'm actually updating my book, If You Love This Planet, that I wrote in 1991 about global warming and climate change and deforestation and toxic pollution and overpopulation and the like. And I feel like renaming it If You Love This Planet - I Told You So, because everything that was predicted by the scientists is now coming to pass. But the one thing that I feel is being neglected in this scientific and political debate on global warming is population. In the year 1800, there were 1 billion human beings. Now there are 6.6 billion human beings. It's predicted by the UN and others that by 2050, there'll be 9 to 9.5 to 10 billion human beings. And many of those billions now obviously want to emulate the United States and the EU and Australia and the like, to have the same standard of living. And indeed, in China, this is absolutely happening with a bang. I think, as a scientist myself, extrapolating, I actually, even though America might change, I don't really know how we're going to stop this huge accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere. Do you? Really being pragmatic.
Well, yes, everybody in China and India wants a car and a refrigerator.
And they're getting them too, what's more.
And the question is, what are the consequences of that going to be? There are technologies that can provide everybody with a nice life without destroying the planet. Yeah. They just have to be implemented. There's enough wind in the world, if we just use wind power, to provide enough energy for everybody on the planet, if we would just put up the windmills. There's enough solar power to do that. It just needs to have an investment to do that, and it has to, you know, if the companies that are making money now would stop fighting against it and get behind it, then it could happen. I don't know if you've been to China recently, but the air is filthy there. Up and down the East Coast, and just from the viewpoint of human health, they're going to have to do something about all their emissions. So I think that it's possible to solve the problem with political will. One of the suggestions is carbon sequestration, that is, burn the coal, but take the carbon dioxide out of the smokestack and pump it back underground.
So what's your analysis of that carbon sequestration?
Well, I think it's a great idea, but we don't have the full-scale technology developed yet.
No, it's like the cure to cancer, right?
Well, no, it's much simpler than that because we know how to do it. We just have to develop it.
Do you really, though? I mean, if you put a huge amounts of volumes of carbon dioxide in the earth, I mean, there are cracks and fissures in the rocks and the like. You can't tell me it won't leak out, Alan.
If it leaks out slowly, that's okay. It doesn't have to stay there permanently. If it leaks out slowly, the system can deal with it. Right now, we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere a million times faster than it came out naturally.
Yeah.
So that would go a way to solve the problem. There's not just one solution. There's many solutions. If we do all of these, wind power, solar power, carbon sequestration,
geothermal,
use energy more efficiently, stop allowing people to drive huge cars, develop public transportation, there'll be lots of economic opportunities and the planet will be safer. But we need some leadership to push people in that direction.
So you think that there is a future possibly for carbon storage and sequestration under the Earth?
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Yeah, I think we just have to try and work on it and figure it out. There's almost no, I mean, right now the federal government of the United States has huge subsidies for the oil industry, for the coal industry, and for the nuclear industry, and there's almost no money being spent on carbon sequestration, on wind power and solar power, because they compete with existing interests.
But I see carbon sequestration rather like putting sulfur particles in the atmosphere to slow global warming down. It gives the coal companies, and in Australia we've got a huge amount of coal, which we're selling to China at a voracious pace. It gives the coal industry a legitimate reason, it seems, for them to keep burning coal. It really curdles my blood a little. I don't quite go for it. And I do know that other people are saying it hasn't been proven.
I gave a talk at the United Nations this summer. The Indonesian mission organized a conference to prepare for the meeting in Bali that was held at the end of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And the delegate from China raised her hand and said, "So you're saying we should do carbon sequestration? If we wanted to start doing it tomorrow with the next coal plant we built, is there technology that's available for us to use?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "No, it's an idea, but it hasn't been developed."
Yeah.
So there's already people are pumping CO2 into abandoned oil wells to try and make the oil come out faster. There are some examples of already doing it, but it would have to be figured out on a large scale basis.
Yeah.
I think that it's a potential, but it's something we have to work on and study in addition to other things.
I've been reading James Hansen lately, the meteorologist from NASA. By God, when you read what he's saying, it makes your blood turn cold. I mean, the temperature's gone up, 0.8 degrees centigrade since the Industrial Revolution began, and it, because of various feedback mechanisms, will go up another 0.4, 0.5.
Another half a degree, yeah.
Yes, and already the Arctic ice cap is melting, and when that melts, the albedo effect of heat being radiated back by the ice into the atmosphere will cease, and the ocean's black and will absorb the heat, and that will then induce more melting of the Greenland ice cap. In other words, Hansen is warning and saying very strongly that we're past the point of no return, and yet even though, I mean, like today, if we stop producing CO2, we're past the point of no return, and yet we keep producing, you know, millions of tons of CO2 being pumped out every day.
What I understand from what Jim says is that we are not yet past the point of no return, but we're very close to it.
Okay.
And that we cannot build another coal-fired power plant without carbon sequestration. That's the biggest thing we can do to slow it down. The oil and natural gas that we have probably will still have to use for mobile sources for a while until we can generate enough electricity to have electric transport.
Right.
But I think he thinks we can solve the problem if we get working on it right now. It's not that we should give up. It's that we have to work much harder at it.
So,
and he's been able to, you know, he's a federal employee, and they tried to stifle him, but he has been speaking out as a private citizen and having a large impact. I know him pretty well, and I really respect the work he's done. In fact, I work on the effects of volcanic eruptions on climate. He was a pioneer in that also a long time ago.
Well, look, I think that what you're all doing is absolutely marvelous. I'm not sure how I can help, but I think that the people listening to this program, I hope you stimulated enough now to know what the problems are in a sort of shorthand way, and that you can't just sit on your couch and watch television anymore, not that probably many of you do. But if you love your children and your grandchildren, which you clearly do, and the roses coming out in the spring and the wisteria and the dogwoods and the orange blossom, if that deeply affects you, and I know it does, that you'll take what you've heard today incredibly seriously, and what you're going to have to do is change the way you live. I mean, not just in putting solar panels on your roof and becoming more efficient and the like, but you're going to have to become incredibly active in your democracy. And I guess it's interesting.
Could I just say a couple of things?
Yeah.
It's more important to change your leaders than to change your light bulbs.
Yes.
And so the most important thing we can do is put somebody else in the White House who will show leadership on this. I also like to say that the problem of nuclear war is the greatest threat humans pose to the planet, not global warming. And we have to solve that so that we have the luxury of taking the time to solve the global warming problem.
Yeah, I mean, as a scientist, could you give the sort of probabilities or risk of actually a nuclear war erupting? Have you got any notion of that, Alan?
No. I can't really predict human behavior. At this Yale conference, one guy said there's a high likelihood within the next 10 years. I think we've been incredibly lucky that no nuclear weapons have been used since the two that we dropped on Japan. Mm-hmm. And the faster we get rid of them, the less is the chance that they can be used.
Well, Alan, on that note, I think we'll end. I think we can solve the problem of global warming by all the measures that you suggested. We can solve the problem of impending nuclear war by rapidly eradicating nuclear weapons, particularly between Russia and America. We can close down all the nuclear power plants tomorrow. We can do that. We're going to have to tighten our belts in terms of energy and electricity and the like. But I think you've given us a really fascinating insight into the main problems facing the planet today and the human species. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart, Alan, for coming on the program.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thanks for giving me this opportunity to tell people about what I'm working on.
Yeah, that's a great pleasure. We'll talk to you again in the future. My guest is Dr. Alan Robock, Professor of Climatology in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. I'm about to play an excerpt from a lecture I gave in 2007 to an audience of early childhood experts and kindergarten teachers in Brisbane, Australia. Now, last but not least, I want to talk about plutonium. Pluto, remember Pluto? He wasn't the dog, he was the god of hell. Right. Plutonium, said to be the most dangerous substance that we know, except that the smoke detectors are fueled by americium-241, which actually is more carcinogenic than plutonium-239, which I'm about to describe. I testified before the New York State Fire Department in 1975, and I begged them not to use americium, which is a waste product of nuclear power. I said, use photovoltaic cells. So they went ahead and used americium, and now it's law that we have to have them in our houses. The nuclear power industry uses their waste. They want to recycle a lot of their waste. It's called below regulatory concern. They deregulate it and say it's okay into belt buckles, children's braces, jewellery, knives and forks, hip replacements. It's all really grand. It's how you make money out of your waste. So plutonium, less than a millionth of a gram is carcinogenic. In fact, when they injected it into beagle dogs, they didn't find one dose low enough that didn't give all the dogs cancer. It gets into the body via the lung, where it causes lung cancer. It's translocated by white blood cells to the mediastinal lymph glands, where it can cause lymphoma and leukemia. It's an iron analog, so it combines with transferrin, the iron transporting protein. So it's stored in the liver, where it causes liver cancer. Goes to the bone, where the hemoglobin obviously is made, where it can cause bone cancer and leukemia. And unlike many other substances, it gets past the placenta into the developing embryo, where, like thalidomide, it's going to kill a cell to form the left half of the brain or the eye, just what I described with uranium. That's called teratogenesis, a chromosomally genetically normal embryo that is damaged by something external to it. The other thing is that it has a predilection for testicles, locating just next to this the cells that are going to form the sperm.
And every male in the Northern Hemisphere has a tiny load of plutonium in his testicles because the fallout from weapons testing days is still coming down. What that means to future generations, we don't know. But you can extrapolate to say it's going to mean a lot. And the incidence of testicular cancer is rising. I think that cremation is medically contraindicated nowadays, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. See, the two air masses don't mix at the equator. So there's a high fallout up there and relatively low here. We've got radiation from the British tests and the French tests, but they've got a huge amount of radiation still coming down from the stratosphere. But if you cremate someone with plutonium in them, the smoke goes out the chimney with the plutonium so you can inhale it ad infinitum for the rest of time. And also cremation adds to global warming, so it's ecologically contraindicated as well. I'm going to be buried in a cardboard coffin while I'm soft to feed the worms. And no formaldehyde, because it's toxic. Now, plutonium happens to have, it's deadly toxic, has a half-life of 24,400 years, so it's around for 500,000 years. And also, you only need 2 kilos to make yourself an atomic bomb. This is the fuel for nuclear weapons, plutonium. You can find the design on the internet. Steal yourself a lump of plutonium the size of a grapefruit. Get stuff from the local hardware shop and make yourself a bomb. And I don't know why there haven't been terrorist weapons yet produced. So it's a carcinogenic industry whose transient byproduct is electricity production. Do you understand? Because you can only have the reactor operating for 20, 30 years. And the radioactive waste is really extraordinary. America's got 50 to 70,000 tons of high-level radioactive waste, incredibly hot, incredibly toxic, in their cooling pools, bubbling away. So they found a mountain in Nevada called Yucca Mountain, good name, Yucca Mountain, transected by 32 earthquake faults, made of pumice. Very permeable. So they've dug big holes in the mountain. They're going to have to transport 1,500 shipments every year for the next 30 years to put the stuff in Yucca Mountain. It's 65 miles from Las Vegas over their aquifer. And why do they start nuclear power? Because the bomb makers, and I knew many of them, worked with them from the Manhattan Project, felt so guilt-ridden about 220,000 people being killed in a flash of light in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that they thought they could harness atoms for peace, but they knew it was evil. Do you know what they called the first bomb ever blown up? Trinity, named after the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And if the bomb didn't work, the telegram to Roosevelt was to read, "It's a girl." It read, "It's a boy." That was an excerpt from a lecture I gave in 2007 at an early childhood conference in Brisbane, Australia. Thank you for listening to If You Love This Planet. We rely on donations to keep this important show on air. If you would like to contribute, please go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Next week, I'll be speaking with Dr. Arjun Makajani about his extraordinary new publication, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for US Energy Policy.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is recorded at 2XX FM Community Radio in Canberra, Australia, and produced by Scott Powell, Amanda Bellerby, and Jasmine Williams. For more information on this program, to listen to previous shows, or to make a donation, visit our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org.